Yama. I'm Kamilaroi and Dangari woman Marley Silva. And this is Always Was, Always Will Be Our Stories, the podcast where I sit down with some of the most inspiring Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander role models in the country. Picture this. In the past 18 months, you've reached some of the biggest milestones of your life so far. You had your first child, a beautiful little boy, married your partner, and graduated from university. It's been some of the best times of your life. You've done all the reading on motherhood and the way things are supposed to go, but you're not obsessing over the milestones your baby is supposed to hit. And when your son is moving at his own pace, that's fine with you. One thing that does cause concern though is the way he's always gagging or choking on his food. You fear that might be something wrong with his tongue, so you take him to the doctor. In that appointment though, your life is turned upside down. The doctor thinks your son might be showing early signs of autism. This is what happened to proud Warramai woman Tanika Davis and her husband Adrian in 2017. Having their son Slade diagnosed with autism was terrifying at the time and raised more questions than answers. But it also set them off on a new journey to turn this new fact into an opportunity to raise awareness and create resources for Aboriginal families in particular with children on the autism spectrum. Tanika is my guest on today's podcast. She's an incredibly wise young woman with a powerful story. And to me, she stands as a testament to the resilience and innovation of our people. So I start every podcast episode with the same question, and it's that age-old one of who's your mob and where are you from?
Awesome. So I am a Warramai woman. I was born in Taree on Biripi country, but grew up in New South Wales. So I'm a New South Wales supporter, and I am coming to you from a Awabakal country. So just recently moved to Newcastle, and so I'm very proud to be able to experience all of the different countries that I've lived on and traveled through. So
it's good to hear Corey say that they're a New South Wales supporter, because I swear there are so many who are like, oh, no, go for Queensland, even though they've never lived there, they're not Murray, nothing. Even my own family does that. So I'm the only New South Wales supporter in my house. I'm like, mate, we've barely spent any time in Queensland. You can't talk about that.
Yeah, definitely.
So thanks so much for being a part of this podcast and coming on to have a yarn, because, you know, I've heard about your story in little dribs and drabs and actually got to meet you in real life after we were kind of Insta friends for a little while, which is so nice. And I'd love to, capture some of the stories I heard you tell at that particular event where we met, about kind of your upbringing. So, I know that you, I'll let you tell it, but what was life like growing up for you?
I grew up in Taree, I was born in Taree, so I was with my dad and my mum, so we travelled around a bit between Taree and Foster, and then we actually was over in Kalgoorlie in WA. And when I was about seven, my stepmum came into our lives, so she was with us for a long time, and went to school in Taree. And yeah, I got the opportunity to move down to Sydney to boarding school, so I was quite lucky living with my dad and my stepmum at the time. But I feel like a lot of things were happening during that time of my life that were quite hard, and obviously not having your real mum around, that played a part as well, with a lot of other things happening that that were out of our control at the time. So yeah, I think for me, where my journey started with identity and culture and was when I moved out of my own community. And I say that with all respect, that, you know, I was able to kind of find out who I was in my own time. And I was lucky that I had some good friends at boarding school when I went there, and they were very proud of where they came from and their culture and their identity, and kind of gave me something to kind of hold on to and, like I said, find out who I was. And I'm very fortunate enough to be in the position where I am now and very proud of who I am. And, you know, it's funny that I look back and think about when I was growing up in high school, about not quite being proud of who I was. And I didn't quite understand that. I didn't understand it because, you know, I was so ashamed about some of the things that were happening in my family and quite, you know, I think it was just, yeah, it was just something that I didn't want to be a part of. And honestly, it took me a long time to figure out who I was and really, you know, be proud of that.
Mm. I feel like that's unfortunately quite a common story for a lot of black fellows growing up because of a whole bunch of influences that really kind of try and dictate to us what it means to be an Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander person. So how old were you when you went to boarding school? And was that through AIEF?
Yeah, so yeah. I was 16. So the end of year 10, I got the scholarship and I didn't go to my senior year, so year 11 and 12.
And what school was that?
I was at King Cobble Rose Bay. So,
oh, nice.
You know, think of like Hogwarts in Sydney. it was like that. Yeah, that was like a pivotal moment because like I wasn't very good at school. Like I struggled at school with a lot of different things, like the aspect of just being able to do my work. And I was in and out of the classroom, kind of, you know, getting sent out of class and all of that kind of stuff. So for me, it was like I was there for the sport kind of, you know, realm. And when I moved down to Sydney, I had to focus on school, like it wasn't a choice. And they kind of used the idea of, you know, you have to be able to complete school to, you know, go overseas to go to sports trips and that kind of thing. So it was kind of the other way around when you went to boarding school. You had to do everything. But I was really lucky that I had two girls there that really took me under their wing, and they knew because they had been there since, you know, year 7 and 8, and mm-hmm. They knew exactly what they were doing. So when it was time to kind of, you know, leave the boarding house and leave the school for the weekend, they knew where they were going. So I felt really comfortable with them. But yeah, it's very different, Sydney, like obviously compared to growing up in a small country town. It's completely different.
How did you find yourself kind of in that new world of this boarding school and everything, thinking about what you wanted to do beyond school? Or did you have any idea, or were you kind of just going through and trying to get it all done?
Yeah, it's funny. Like I didn't really have like a set, like when I was in year 12, I was like, I didn't want to be something. Like I just, for me, it was like, I just wanted to get through school. So it's funny because you go through like year 12 and you get to the middle of year 12 and they're talking about UAC and filling out your UAC papers to get into uni. And I suppose in that area where I lived, the girls there, they knew exactly what they wanted to do from the minute they were in year 7. Like all their family had influence of what they should be doing. But for me, I didn't really know exactly what I was doing. So I actually did TAFE straight out of school. Like I just thought, you know, I'm not going to go to uni. Wasn't really quite something that I wanted to do straight away. So I went to TAFE and I did a traineeship at the NRL. So when I worked there, I was able to be in my role and working, but do my traineeship. So I completed that quite quickly in the year that I worked there. And then I stayed on at the NRL for a number, probably like 4 years after that. And my position changed from being an event assistant to community programs. So I was able to shift kind of where my passion was, and I suppose for me it was going out to communities and spreading the message of NRL, and that was kind of like my dream job. And I thought that I was going to be in that dream job for quite a long time, but it shifted a bit then. You know, as I got a bit older, I understood that if I wanted to do something, you know, like be a teacher or do something else, I had to go to uni. I actually started uni, not sure, probably 2014. And I started in teaching. So I did 2 years of teaching. And then I just dropped out. Like it was something that I thought I wanted to do. But obviously I could not be doing that. Like I just didn't see myself being in a classroom. So I deferred uni and kept working. And it wasn't until I left NRL, and I started at the University of Sydney in their Indigenous recruitment kind of area, and I worked there for maybe 3 years, and I went back to uni then. Again, I did business like at UTS for a year, and I was like, this is so hard. and I ended up falling pregnant with Slade and having Slade, and I didn't ever go back to uni until he was born. So I went back to uni in 2017 and graduated. I did finish this time. So I did Indigenous Health Promotion and, finished that. That year was quite a crazy year. Like I had Slade in 2016 and 2017, went back to uni. I was planning our wedding. We got married that year, finished uni. So like that was my big year. But, I did enjoy that year in terms of, you know, being able to finish and accomplish something. After being a mum, like it's quite a new, it's just crazy being a mum. But I think when you do something other than being a mum, like it really keeps your focus on non-mumsy things, I suppose. So
I feel like when you're at school, you kind of get told there's like one way to do things and it's got to be like finish school, do the tertiary education, get the job, that's it sort of thing. And, you know, you did 1 year of business and then did health promotion, but now you've got a business. Yeah. Like that's the coolest thing ever. Like congratulations in what you've done and like the perseverance to just keep trying things and especially you talking about doing the non-mum things to do the mum things basically is really, really cool. It would be great to talk about Slade because obviously he's a massive part of what you do now. So how old is he now? My math is bad.
He's almost four. Wow. So, yeah, like when I think about that, it makes me so sad because like my little baby's gone. But he is, almost four. He's four this month. So yeah, like I suppose for us, like thinking back to when he was born, we had a quite rough birth, I suppose. It was quite traumatic and we spent about a week in the NICU unit when he was born. And I don't know, for me, I was like, was it normal to have that kind of traumatic experience? Like I think of a lot of my friends who have had babies or, you know, nothing really kind of traumatic happened in their birth. Like it was long and hard, but nothing kind of like that. But no major issues. Like we were just there for precaution. I had really good support in the community, at the time. So we were actually down in Sydney, when we had Slade. And I don't know, like for me, I was kind of trying not to do things by the book, as a mum. Like you read so much about like being like what to do by milestones and, you know, should they be crawling? Should they be walking? All of that kind of thing. I think for me personally, it was like I didn't know what to look for. So I was just, you know, keeping up with kind of what he was doing. It wasn't until about 18 months. So he wasn't a late walker. He wasn't a late crawler. He met all of those kind of milestones. It wasn't until he was like 18 months going on, you know, kind of two, and saying words, like the worst thing I could have done is compared my child to other kids around his age, because I would find them, you know, saying mum and dad or saying yes, no. And like Slade didn't, he like lacked that. Like he would say dad and mum, but in his own time. So yeah, we were in Sydney at the time, and we were going just to get some checkups at the ped. And at the time, the pediatrician kind of gave us a few questions about like what he was doing, and we did think that what Slade was doing was kind of normal. Like he would sit in front of the like light switch and flick it on and off a few times, and you know, we'd take him away from that. And like he was obsessed with fans, so he would watch the fan for like, you know, ages, and we thought that that was normal. And it wasn't until kind of the doctor, you know, what he was eating as well, like every time he'd eat, he would kind of like, you know, gag or choke or something like that. So we thought that there was something wrong with his tongue. There wasn't anything wrong with his tongue. His like gross motor skills were really great. Like he was walking and running, and, you know, he could do everything except like communicate to us. So he couldn't, you know, say those little words. And like the pediatrician, when we went into that appointment, he was like, oh, have you ever heard of autism? And we're like, what? Like, I hadn't heard of it. Like, I'll be totally honest. Like, kind of went in there with an idea of, you know, he's just going to say, it's this. Like, we just thought there was something else. And he said, yeah, I think that he might have early signs of autism. And we're like, what? Like, I said, like, is it something that can go away? Like, what is it? And like, he gave us some pamphlets straight away on what it was. And like, got back in the car, and I just remember sitting there, and I thought, like, why? What do you mean, like, Slade has autism? Like, it was kind of like just like a punch in the face. And I honestly felt, like I felt like we were lucky, like we were very lucky that we had picked it up early. At 18 months is quite early. We didn't get a formal diagnosis until later on, obviously, because he wasn't old enough to, you know, get a diagnosis in terms of NDIS and everything. But we did get that. And I remember like Adrian was with me too, and he was like, oh, it's all right, like we'll be right. You know, it's just something that we have to deal with. And the more that I kind of, I went into this like complete freak out mode too, because I was thinking in my head, like, I don't even know what this is. How am I even going to cope if I don't know what it is? So I kind of went on the reverse of everything. Like, I started reading books. I like, you know, when I was at uni during that year and doing Indigenous health promotion, I started asking questions to my lecturer and other, you know, peers in the class about it. And my lecturer at the time, she was doing like this paper on FASD, and she was talking about like fetal alcohol syndrome and how it affects the baby. And obviously that was something that affected me personally, but, you know, like she was talking about how, you know, that syndrome can play a part in, you know, having early developmental delays as well. So she was trying to explain to me all these different angles, and she didn't really have an answer for me. She was just kind of doing the same thing, like giving me books and different things to read up on. And during that time, we had moved out to Dubbo. So we moved out to Dubbo after I finished uni in 2018. And that's when we kind of started getting that formal diagnosis done. So we were able to get a good pediatrician out there and see her for a longer period, and her to like see other things that Slade was doing. And I know when he got to about two, that year between two and three, that's when we really started to notice things. Like he was getting really frustrated with just us trying to communicate with him, because I knew he wanted to talk to us, but he just couldn't get it out. And like every other mum would appreciate that when something is going wrong, and I say wrong in inverted commas, like it's not wrong, this disorder. It's just you have to kind of change your whole outlook on life, and you have to really sit back and think, well, you know, this is something that is going to stay with our family for our life, the whole of Slade's life, and what can we do now, like, to help him, like, just to make things easier. I was really lucky out in Dubbo because we had a really good support system out there in terms of really good friends, and some of them had worked in OT and speech, and then you had others that were teachers. So I was really lucky that I had a good group of friends out there, and Adrian and I worked in health at the time out there. So we again, were really lucky that we were firsthand getting the help that we needed. And I suppose that's where organically kind of, you know, our story kind of took off, and our idea of our story was to tell it in a light that it was so scary, but it's not something that, you know, our life didn't end. You know, Slade's still very healthy. The only thing that kind of stops us day to day is, you know, it's balancing, you know, do you go for a walk with him, or do you go for a walk with him and have, you know, 6 or 7 meltdowns during your walk and take 2 hours? You know, it's like you have to really like balance out what you do in your day-to-day life. And I think that's a turning point in any kind of disability space, I suppose, because if it impacts your day-to-day life, then things become an issue. But I think for me personally, I like to challenge Slade a lot. I've learnt a lot of patience. I never had patience, but I definitely have learnt that. And, you know, I think that's something that you have to really kind of hold on to, is patience and love. Like, he just, you know, he wants to be loved, and like all kids, they want to be kissed and cuddled and just shown that someone cares for them. So, you know, if moving forward for the rest of our lives, if we can do that, then I know that he feels safe and he feels wanted. He's not different. Like, he's still, you know, typical, doing typical four-year-old things. And fast forward to now, like, he is doing some really amazing things in terms of his development. You know, we've just been able to complete a whole year of NDIS, where he was doing speech and OT weekly, and we had an educator as well. So, you know, I think once you find that rhythm, in terms of what goals and what needs to be met at a certain time, then that's when things started to fall in place with us. But I do say that lightly because I'm only a mum to one child. Like, there's mothers out there, and in particular, you know, our mob, that don't necessarily, you know, have the help or have, you know, enough courage to fill out those forms. And that's the kind of thing that where our business starts now, is because we want to be able to give people that voice and that platform to share their stories, because like, we had it wasn't easy. Like, I didn't even know what autism was. So it's about sharing stories, good and bad. You know, it's not all going to be amazing stories, but I think if we can all, like, put our stories together and talking about how real it is, it's real, and it's kind of like, it's an unknown. And I laugh about, like, how crazy this world is now, because it's the unknown, right? It's something that we live through, like, with a kid with ASD every day. It's an unknown. Like, we can have a really good day where we think we can go and, you know, go to the park one day without Slade having, you know, some sort of meltdown, or go for a walk and it will only take us an hour. But then there's other days where we will literally stay at home in our pajamas and just let him be, you know, just let him be able to cope in his own environment. yeah, so that's our story. Like, we just, I think for us it's like more about being positive in this, in what we're going through, because you can be very easily disheartened about anything that's kind of attached to your child. I think as a mom and as a dad, and you just you want what's the best for them, and you want to be able to give them everything that, like my husband says, like everything that you, like he never had, like he wanted, you know, Slade to potentially play football one day, and I mean, he might play footy one day, we never know, but you know, he might also be an analyst for a rugby league team, like, I don't know. It's just, you know, it's an unknown.
Yeah. I think, you know, I probably want to preface for people listening that I think you could be easily mistaken for being much older than what you are because of your wisdom. And you are still a, you know, a young woman, and just the maturity you have, because, you know, I'm not a parent, but I can't even imagine how, you know, scary it must be, like what you said with those first conversations. And I feel like, you know, for me, I feel like autism is a word I've heard a lot, but I don't understand it. And, you know, I've met, you know, different people and different kids on different parts of the spectrum, and the whole idea of it being a spectrum, like, it's just crazy. And, I think, you know, did you find that, like, within your personal circles that, people needed that awareness as well? Like, is, and I guess that's probably what was behind the inspiration, behind the I Am movement, which is your business. Yeah, I'd love to talk about how you navigate kind of those, I don't know, but I guess there's probably been some not so positive reactions when you talk about, or, yeah. So you say ASD, is that autism spectrum disorder? Is that what it?
Yeah. So it's quite, yeah, ASD. So autism spectrum disorder. So, you know, it's funny that you say this, because we had to do our own kind of education around what it was, and I'm still learning every day. And that's the best thing about, you know, something so big and so, I don't know what the word is, like, it's something that's out there, but again, like, people have this stigma attached to autism. And, you know, one of the key messages I'd love for people to actually understand about this is, don't judge, like, don't judge if you think that kid in the screaming store is just screaming because they want a chocolate. Like, there's so many elements to autism spectrum disorder that people don't quite understand, like, you know, sensory, like, set high sensory needs, low sensory needs, people that necessarily, they do want to be able to communicate to you, but communicate in a different way without eye contact. You know, like, for me personally, like, Slade loves to touch things and loves to touch people, and, you know, like, he will do really weird things, like touch someone that he doesn't know. And I think, you know, for us, that's something that we couldn't stop him from doing anymore. Like, that was just how he stimmed. Like, the stimming reaction to him getting that, he feels good when he does that. So, you know, I've had to learn that, to not stop him from doing the things that makes him feel good inside. And, you know, I'm not Slade. I don't have autism. I'm just trying to do my best as a mum, as someone who's advocating for him, to understand. And it's really hard. It's really hard to navigate every day, because, like I said, it's not every day is the same. Not every autistic person is the same. Not everyone's family dynamics are the same. And this goes with everything that I'm saying. Like, if I was talking about mental health, like, that's never going to be the same for one person. So it's being mindful and being aware about what you're doing in that time, I suppose. And I'll go back to that shopping center example, because that's something that, like, people joke about, you know, oh, I saw a screaming child in aisle, what, 6, screaming around for chocolate and whatever. But for me, that's actually happened. And like the amount of times I've had people say, like, just give him a chocolate. Like, I sit there and I think, you have no idea. Like, and I have to really bite my tongue in that moment, because I'm kind of like, for me personally, I'm like a really like, I'll just tell it how it is. Like, and when it's your son, it's your blood, like, you'll be able to, you know, as a mum, like, you just want to bite back at that person. And it becomes then like a personal feud in the shopping centre. But I look and I think, I have to really sit and think, well, they're not educated enough to understand maybe something else is happening. You know, the lights in the shopping centre are on too much. The music's so loud. The beeping is happening in the checkout. People are talking. People are packing things in their trolleys. Trolley wheels are going. Like, Slade is like, can hear all of that. And he feels all of that. And I know he does, because we try and limit our shopping experiences. And I say this very lightly, because like I said, when you want to just go do a few things in the shop, it becomes, he's fixated then on the aisle numbers. So we have to go through every aisle and, you know, not necessarily get anything out of the aisles, but go through all the aisles, you know, touch all the fruit that, you know, you shouldn't be touching because people are trying to buy them. So we don't limit it because we're worried about people's reactions. We limit it because for the safety of him. And, you know, there is times and places where, like I said, we want to challenge Slade, because I find, and this is not in everyone else's cases, but I find with Slade that we challenge him and he doesn't like it once. We do it one more time. If he doesn't like it, then we kind of sit back and do it a bit differently. But I went over to Samoa last year for a good friend of ours, their wedding, and I actually went on the plane by myself without AJ. And that was crazy. I didn't know, like, why I should have done that, but I did it because I knew that Slade, first of all, we wanted a holiday in another country, this Slade, but he, we turned it into like this big story about airplanes and, you know, what the resort looked like we're going to stay at. And so for him, we turned it into a game like a week or a month out before even going. So when we got to the airport, he was like visually aware of what was happening around us. Like, he loved being able to see the planes. We were trying to explain to him how loud they were. Although during this time he's not saying anything to us, his receptive skills are just so high. It's crazy. Like, we could say to him, you know, Slade, can you go get the red pen out of the office? Like, he'll run and go get the red pen out of the office. Like, he understands everything. But the thing is, like, I suppose for us as parents, it's a frustrating thing, is that we just want him to be able to communicate with us. Like, I do go back to, like, comparing. Like, my sister's got a son the same age. They're 2 weeks apart. So he's nearly four as well. And he is, like, got an older brother, and he can sit there and talk to me like an adult. Like, he can sit and just yarn and say, how's your day, Auntie Nika? And, like, you sit there and you just think, what the hell? Like, why is this kid be, like, he can talk, like, underwater. But then you've got Slade, who, necessarily can't say, you know, five or six words. At that time, he couldn't. But that's something that, personally for me, I had to get through. I had to understand and recognise, you know, well, my nephew doesn't have autism. But the thing is, like, the more that they were together, he was able to teach Slade different things. So it's a never-ending learning curve. And we had to essentially teach, you know, for my dad, for example, who's someone that comes from a really old school kind of approach, like, oh, he'll be right, like, you know, yous were just mucking up when yous were younger, like, you know, that kind of thing. But I had to sit down, like, say, Dad, like, you know, do you even know what autism is? Like, it's okay, because we didn't know what it was. But I found that I was trying to educate my own family, like, to the best that I could. And that's when I was like, okay, I have to really sit back and think, what, where do I want this to go? Do I just want it to be a conversation, you know, every time I have to talk to people about Slade, or every time someone says, oh, like, why doesn't he talk? Like, he's almost four. That's where it was kind of a pivotal moment for us in starting what we do. And that's how it started. Like, the I Am movement is based on not necessarily a movement. It's more just a platform for us to share our story and have other people who may be living with autism or have a child or have a nephew, niece, you know, or just know someone with autism, that to be safe and to feel like their voice is heard. Like I said, we don't necessarily want it to be something that's negative and seen as a really bad stigma. And for us, we started this organically. I suppose it started off as a idea in our lounge room about creating some culturally appropriate visuals for Slade. In particular, at that time, we wanted to try and limit that screen time and try and give him a bit of more one-on-one. And that was kind of advice from our OT and speechy at the time. And they didn't have anything to give us. So when you go to these appointments and when you go to these, like when you go and get all your therapy done, you kind of leave with something, and you leave with like a, I don't know, in my, like where I was at the time, we left with a goodie bag full of, you know, things about autism, what autism was, and really, like, it was great information, but there was nothing cultural. Like, where for us as Aboriginal people, like, we want to feel culturally connected with it, with whatever we do, like, so, you know, that was where it was kind of in business terms a market for us. But like I said, it wasn't something that we intentionally wanted to, you know, provide to people. It was just something that we thought would be amazing for Slade. And we commissioned Adrian's pop. So Richard Paul Campbell, who has been an artist for over, you know, his whole life pretty much, and a member of the Stolen Generation and a really prominent artist in his realm and what he does, we basically gave him the idea and he just did it, you know, he did it and came out with, you know, the whole alphabet and letters 1 to 10. And when we got them back, like, I was just crying. I was like, I don't know how an artist can just take this concept and just do it. Like, but, you know, the stories behind, you know, our letters and our numbers, for example, it's something really close to home for us, and we wanted to give them to other people to not necessarily have this educational tool, but have the story behind it and have that as a meaningful thing to give to their kids or leave in the waiting room at a doctor's. And it's, you know, I'm not even a year into the business and I feel like I said, it's not something that I wanted to do as a business, but no one has ever done it from a grassroots point of view. Like, there's companies out there that potentially use Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander stories to, you know, get the message out there, whether it's a video or whatever. But from a mum's point of view, you know, like I said, I'm not the expert in this field, but I'm potentially giving other mothers and fathers and aunties and uncles and grandparents a platform to be able to do that. And that's where we're at the moment. Like, we've sold out of all of our stock. We've had to reinvent the stock wheel, and we've added new resources into that. And, you know, it's exciting. It's an exciting, like I said, it's not so mumsy, but it is, like, it's a different passion. And I suppose for me, I'm trying to join, you know, being a really passionate mum with my expertise in Indigenous health promotion into one. And, you know, people people just see me as like this really passionate mum, which I am, but I'm not creating this based on, you know, just Slade. I'm creating it based on, you know, multiple phone calls and video conferences at the moment around developing new stock and talking to actual autistic Aboriginal people. Like, they're the kinds of people that have lived through it. They're old enough now to share their story. And I think that's the real pivotal kind of moment now where we're sitting, and with time on our hands, we've been able to kind of think about where else do we want the story to go.
Yeah, wow. That's incredible to turn this around to be something for everyone else. Is so amazing. And I think that it's only going to have, more and more impact on every person who comes across it, because I think, you know, it's very rare to meet someone who doesn't know someone with a kid who's been diagnosed or has interacted with someone with autism in their life. And it's so important that we have that education. I think it's something we've really lagged in as a country, if not as a, you know, the human race. So, yeah. I won't keep you too much longer, but I wonder, it is hard because you're only at the beginning of it, but what would be like your big dream of this journey, you know, in the next 5 years?
I don't know. I thought that my big dream with this kind of thing was being able to create a podcast, but that's in living motion at the moment for me. But the next 5 years, you know, I have to think about this in a really like personal way, I suppose, because Slade will be that little bit older, and I think that's the beauty of what the business is. Like, I'm kind of molding the business around Slade, and you know, I hope that, you know, 5 years down the track, he can be able to voice his story. But, you know, if that doesn't happen, then I'm just going to be still doing what I'm doing in terms of telling our story. And I think my biggest dream out of this is to have Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families feel comfortable in telling the wider community that, hey, like, my son or daughter has autism. That's why she's acting like that, or that's why he's feeling that. And to not feel shame about sharing that. I think a lot of people, they throw off on the idea of they've got autism, and they don't want to actually say that A word. They don't want to do it. but this is where you can kind of sit and understand, and sharing your story is actually like a form of therapy. The more times that I share it, the more times that I feel like, you know, I feel great. Like, I don't feel nervous about sharing it. The first couple of times I did, it was like, oh, I've got to say, like, my son's got autism, how are people going to be? And it's not something that you want people to feel sorry for. Like, you don't want them to say, how are you? You just want them to be able to say, oh, okay, like, and then ask the questions. And then that's where the conversation starts. It's a conversation starter. And, you know, for my close friends, they'll understand why I didn't come to that dinner, or I pulled out last minute on coming to a coffee date. Like, they're the real valuable people that you got to keep in your life, because they understand. I don't do the whole mother's group kind of thing, because it's a completely different feeling for us to do that. But I think, you know, going back to the 5 years, it'll be definitely just being able to be that platform that everyone goes to and everyone feels that they're safe. And I think there is that side of, you know, the business where we haven't kind of jumped into yet, but Adrian's been really passionate about sharing his story as a dad, because, you know, as mums, we have this approach that, you know, I'm their mum, like, I know everything. but for dads, it's completely different, because they sit back and they watch everything, and they think differently and they learn differently, and they want to teach their son or daughter differently, but not necessarily having the tools too. So watch this space. Could be a good opportunity for Adrian to share his story and, you know, build his own platform, I suppose.
Yeah, amazing. Well, speaking of watching this space, it's probably good to finish with where people can find you and stay up to date and support what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. So we're predominantly on social media, so at the I Am Movement, and we've got a website as well, so www.theiammovement.com.au. That's where you can find our products and keep up to date with our stories as well.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much again for sharing this. I think that, it's something that we don't hear about enough. And, you know, your personal story and, you know, what you've done is really inspiring. And, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Always Was, Always Will Be Our Stories. Thank you to Tanika for coming on and sharing your journey. And if you want to support her work, make sure you check her out on Instagram at the I Am Movement. Always Was, Always Will Be Our Stories is written, produced, hosted, recorded, the whole bit by me, Marley Silva. I do so on the unceded lands of the Jarawal people south of Sydney and pay my respects to their elders past and present and acknowledge their unbroken connection to this land that has lasted for over 60,000 years. If you're enjoying the show, make sure you subscribe, share it with someone else who you think might enjoy it too, and follow us on social media at Always Our Stories on Instagram and Facebook. That's all from me. Have a great rest of the week and catch you next time. Stay deadly.